Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, May 20th, 2008 Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting. We'll begin with requests from visitors and speakers from the floor. I don't have anybody signed up. Is there anyone who's here to speak on an item that's not on our agenda? If not, move on to our consent agenda. Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item one is approval of the minutes of the previous meetings of April 15th, 22nd, and May 13th. Item two, appointments to the Environmental Advisory Board. Item three is award of a construction contract for the 2007-2008 street resurfacing project. Item four is a request to make an appointment to the Orange County Solid Waste Advisory Board. Item five is a town code amendment for bicycle lanes on Old Fayetteville Road. Item six is a request to amend the street assessment policy. Item seven, an ordinance dissolving the Cemetery Commission and the Cable TV Committee. Item eight is a request to set a public hearing on a draft ordinance amending the land use ordinance to allow mobile prepared food vendors in certain districts. And item nine, appointments to the Appearance Commission and / Neighborhood Preservation District Commission.
Most of the items?
I think we have one proposed amendment to one of the
Yes,
minutes.
I do. And that's to the April 15 minutes on request for approval, municipal agreement with the DOT for the greenways. I would just like to amend the minutes so that they reflect that in my statement, the goal is to have, and I was trying to bring it around to what the EAB said, the goal is to have environmentally sensitive paved surface, concrete or asphalt, which is consistent with the EAB's recommendations. Thank you.
So moved on with that correction.
And now I'll second it.
Okay. The consent agenda has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Is Sarah Sizemore here? Sarah, if you could come up. Sarah is joining the Recreation and Parks Commission. If you'll stand in front of the town clerk here, she is going to read you your charge.
As a Recreation and Parks Commission member, you will, number one, advise the Board of Aldermen and Town Administration concerning the acquisition of real or personal property to be used for park or recreation purposes and the maintenance and use of all town-owned, leased, or operated parks and recreational facilities, the operation of all recreational programs, and future needs for the acquisition of additional recreation facilities or the expansion of recreational programs and alternative means of acquiring such facilities or operating such programs, and two, report to the Board of Aldermen as requested by the Board and undertake such studies or perform such duties as the Board may request from time to time. If I could get you to sign that, agreeing to that. Meet the board.
Okay. And now we will turn to agenda item D1. Okay. Manager.
This is a receipt of the Tree City USA Award in recognition of winners in the poster and poetry contest. Town of Carrboro has been named a Tree City USA by the National Arbor Day Foundation to honor its commitment to its community forests, and this is the 24th year Carrboro has received this national recognition. Student winners of the poster and poetry contest will attend the meeting and be recognized by the town, and George has promised he won't share any of his poetry tonight.
Good evening, everyone. I enjoy doing this every year. I believe this is the fifth year that I've been able to do this and present the just short presentation on our Arbor Day activities that we have annually. And tonight, besides showing a few slides, I know we have a couple of the students, I think three or four of the poetry and poster contest winners from Carrboro Elementary here tonight. to receive a certificate. So this is the, as the manager said, the 24th consecutive year that Carver has been named a Tree City USA by the National Arbor Day Foundation. Excuse me a second here. In order to qualify for this slide, town must meet four requirements. Must have a tree ordinance, which we do, which is Article 19 of our land use ordinance. Have a tree board, an expenditure of at least $2 per capita on tree maintenance, and an annual Arbor Day observance. And this year's annual Arbor Day observance was at Carborough Elementary on Friday, April 25th. And at this moment, I want to acknowledge all those who were involved at the school, science teacher Mrs. Dale Tregott, Principal Emily Bivens, and Public Works staff, Lakeisha White-Kelly, our administrative assistant, and Paul Helwig, our landscape and ground supervisor. Paul, would you stand up? He is here tonight, who helped make a lot of the arrangements. And also the landscape and ground crews who helped plant the tree, and especially Donnie Barber, who moonlights once a year as Smokey. We also had the State Forester's Office represented, Jason Presley, and Mayor Mark Chilton attended.
They're going to make me wear the suit next year.
Here's a quick slide that shows the activities that took place at Arbor Day. Flag was presented, a Tree City USA flag from the State Forester to the Mayor. The students had already competed in a poster and poetry contest, and we had planted a crabapple tree. I just have a few slides here to show some of the activities. I believe the students here are talking about the history of Arbor Day. Who says Arbor Day isn't fun? And I believe those are our three poster contest winners. And then this is the crabapple tree that everybody, some patiently, some not so patiently, waited to help plant.
It's in the bus circle.
It was a beautiful day, and you can see also some of the other grounds crews as the tree was already in place, and then we asked the students to help backfill around the tree. Anyway, it's a beautiful day, a nice activity, and there were activities indoors as well. And Mayor Chilton, if you'd come forward, we'll recognize some of the winners. I'll read all the names, and I know not all the students are here tonight. On the poster contest, third place was Kiara Dean. Kiara, can you come up, please? Let me quit. I won't read all of these, but let me tell you what the certificates say. Kiara Dean has presented an outstanding creative representation of how trees grow and function. Through artistic expression, Kiara has communicated a message of hope for the future of our planet. Let it be known that the town of Carborough recognizes the unique and creative contributions offered by our nation's youth and extends special appreciation for these efforts. Congratulations, Kiara. Second place was Callie Reich. Is Callie here? And first place in the poster contest was Gussie Hollers. I don't believe Gussie is here either. All right, and then in the poetry contest, third place was Jonathan Phillips. And second place was Weston Barker, and I believe Weston is here. Come up, Weston. Do you have this?
Come read it for us. Oh, right. Come stand up with the microphone.
Just sit there.
Trees are beautiful. There's no place that I'd rather be than up my rope ladder sitting in a tree. Relaxed in the branches, you can read or toss a ball, swing your feet or look around, just be careful not to fall. Trees provide the perfect place to hide when you're a child, towering over adults. Below, your imagination can go wild. What a place for me to be, on my own, and in a tree.
Aww.
Congratulations. It's got a Robert Louis Stevenson thing going on there.
Excellent.
All right.
And I'll read just the last name of the first place in the poetry contest was Blake Etheridge, and I'm not sure if Blake is here. Oh, yes, she is. I'm sorry, Blake. Yes.
Outside, I'm gazing at nature's beloved gift. The trees surround me.
Thank you to the students and parents and family members who came to support tonight. Thank you very much for all coming.
All right. Thank you, Norm.
The special thanks definitely go to the person who has to wear that Smokey the Bear suit. It was hot that day. All right. Thank you all for coming.
Move the resolution.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Great.
And now we are on to item D2, our monthly OWASA drought update. There is nothing to make it rain.
Excuse me.
Like scheduling a drought update. Yes.
It's Irwin.
Could we possibly have the poems posted on our website somewhere? I think people would love to read
them. And the picture.
Yeah.
You can scan it.
Somehow.
We'll have to track them down, but...
Let's see what we can do.
Yeah, I think people would enjoy them.
Yeah.
We should at least make sure we get them into the citizen.
Good suggestion.
Good evening. Pictured here is the water supply headquarters, also known as Carbaryl Town Hall. As you pointed out, we've had a really good batting average of rain when I show up for an update. But the news is all good. We're at 85% full and probably a little bit higher after this evening's rain. And that's quite an improvement in 2.5 months when we were at only 40% full in early March and quite concerned. The OWASA staff, we've made a recommendation for the OWASA board to consider at their board meeting this Thursday to rescind stage one and declare water supply advisory. We're not ready to say the drought is over, but certainly our risk situation is much, much improved. And I have a slide on this later, but the OWASA customers just continue to do a great job conserving. You've seen this graph many times, and you can see the dramatic increase in supply from a low of 40% in early March to about 85% currently. Here's an illustration of the great job the OWASA customers continue to do. The green line is our pre-drought projections of how much water we would sell, and that's in million gallons a day, and of course time is here. And you can see the goal was reduced from a 20% reduction under stage 3 to a 10% reduction when we went to stage 1. And as you can see, the customer demand actual is 20-25% or more. So, and of course, the rainy weather and cooler temperatures has contributed to that. But we also know that our customers have learned even better habits. And just as was our experience after the drought of 2001-2002, we expect that trend of lower water use to continue throughout the year, irregardless of the weather conditions. Our risk is quite low now. Even if we start June at a lower level than we are currently, 80% full, if you superimpose the drought of 2002 and 2007, even if we had a repeat of last year's drought, we would not drop to our 20% threshold where we don't want to fall below. So again, risk is quite low over the next year and a half, and I love the weatherman's forecast, equal chance of average rainfall. What we're learning that in the summer it's really difficult to predict rainfall, although in the winter they do a better job. And you know, over the winter we were projected to have below average rainfall. Of course we did until early March. And I'll be happy to answer any questions or receive your feedback.
I just want to thank you, Ed, for your continual updates. I've been on the website many times, and I was a naysayer in April 28th meeting, I think it was, and I just want to thank you, you know, for all the conservation efforts Owosso has made, and I'm just pleased as punch. It's been raining and hailing and giving us lots of recharge, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Glad to be proved wrong.
Yes, yes.
John and Dan.
I'm just curious. Again, thank you for the excellent work Owosso does. Makes me feel very proud. But I'm just curious to know how much can we conserve without raising our rates, like had happened in Charlotte, where people just conserve so much that, you know, at some point you can go so low that you have to rake, you know, cover your cost.
Well, and that is extremely timely question for us, because this year, and the, again, you see the green line, that was our pre-drought projections. In other words, that was how much water we expected to sell each of those months here in the spring. So our revenue is significantly down this year. And, of course, we don't want to run out of water. I'd rather run out of money than run out of water, okay? But there is a financial reality to the conservation, and that is our revenues are down quite a bit. And while some of our costs are variable in that less energy and less chemicals when we produce and pump less water, but most of our costs are fixed. 60% of our budget is salary and benefits. And, you know, and so we expect to have about a $1.5 million deficit this year, and that's even after a committed savings of $1.3 million over what was approved for spending. So we have frozen over a dozen positions right now. We've stopped all discretionary spending. And even with that, we're going to see our reserves dwindle quite a bit this year. And next year, you know, our board is looking at a high double-digit rate increase possibly because of going into next year, we expect demand to remain depressed. So unfortunately, there are some financial realities that we're having to address.
Thank you.
Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. My question has to do with given that we're lower today than we were a year ago, is the recommendation you're making on Thursday, that's really, if I'm understanding correctly, that's based on the rain forecast as opposed to more so or as much as our current status?
It certainly,
is that right?
Yeah, it certainly considers the forecast, but it also takes a look at the risk. And you know, so even though last May we were full or nearly full and we're 15% less this year, you know, if we had that same drought conditions in 2007, which it was quite severe, record-breaking drought for us, you know, our supply wouldn't get much below 25%. So it also has a lot to do with the risk, which we believe is low. But, again, we're not suggesting that this drought is over, but what we've really seen is the tremendous job our customers are doing conserving. So given our very low customer demand, you know, an average chance of normal rainfall through the summer and low risk, we think the combination of those things would support, you know, our recommendation for relaxing from stage one to advisory. But again, we are dialed into this and something we'll watch, you know, extremely closely, and of course, always welcome your feedback and guidance as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your work. We're hoping not to see you for a while. All right. With that, we'll move on to item D3, a presentation on interim solid waste plan.
This is a report on the update of the required three-year update on the 10-year solid waste management plan for the county and the municipalities within the county, and there's a resolution for the board to consider which would accept the report and offer any comments back to Orange County. And Blair Pollack and Gail Wilson are here. Blair, are you doing the honors tonight?
Okay. Good evening. We have a report for you. I have to learn your system a little bit here, I guess. I wanted to just show you the slideshow, not all the notes here. So
local government would just grind to a halt without PowerPoint.
It might. Might have to actually look at the person. Thank you. Okay, so I can actually use the button. Okay, good. Well, looks like I can't. There we go. The state of North Carolina requires us to produce a 10-year solid waste plan, and it also requires a 3-year update to the plan. So the good news is we're here to present that 3-year update, and the bad news is it's about 2 years behind schedule. We've been working diligently with our solid waste plan work group, and the solid waste plan work group has been engaged since 2005 in producing what we hope will be a integrated long-term plan that will continue to drive us towards our 61% waste reduction goal. A couple of the reasons that we have been taking so long is that we do engage in a collective process with the three towns and the university. It's very deliberate, it's very thorough, and it involves a lot of players. So we do want to submit this as a group in our 2004 plan. All the governments did sign on. UNC is not a signatory to the plan, but they have been integrally involved, and they do represent 10% of all the solid waste that comes to the landfill. So they're a major player. They also produce 3,000 to 4,000 tons of recyclables a year, so they're also a significant potential recycling player. We have several benchmarks we have to meet. One of them is to hold a public hearing on the plan, which we did May 1st. We did not, unfortunately, get any public comments on the plan. We are also producing a presentation for you all for the town of Chapel Hill, which approved the plan last night, and for the town of Hillsborough, which heard from us last week, and they plan to make a decision on May 27th as to their decision about signing on to this plan. It's not formally referred to as an interim plan, but just between us, we'll refer to it as an interim plan in the sense that it's more descriptive than it really is a true plan that's going to drive us towards the 61% goal. We felt a certain obligation to get the work done, to have something on the books, and as much as for anything else, for the selfish reason of being able to chase some of the not inconsiderable state grant money that will be available next year. Historically, the state's had about $250,000 in solid waste grant funds, but because of the new $2 a ton solid waste tax that the state is levying beginning July 1, there'll be $23 million in that pot of money, and in year one, about $2.5 million of that will be earmarked for competitive state grants. Interestingly, for each of the three towns and the county, another piece of that money will come back to each of the towns and the county based on population. So beginning next November, you will see a nice a surprise check in the mail to the equivalent of about, it's been projected, 80 cents per capita per year. That's where some of that money is going to come back to. What we're asking for is that each of the four governments considers the plan. The significant things, I think, for you all with respect to next year are there are no financial obligations to approving this and no policy changes required. I did want to go through briefly several of the highlights and talk to you a little bit. It's not like because we don't have a plan in place that we've been inactive over the last several years, so I wanted to highlight some of the work that the Solid Waste Department's done, talk about some of the elements of this current plan, what we've been deliberating. Mayor Chilton's one of the members of your Solid Waste Plan work group, along with key Carborough staff, Chapel Hill staff, and Hillsborough and County staff as well, and the Solid Waste Advisory Board, of which you have two active and very participatory members. So there's really been quite a bit of dialogue about solid waste. And the predominant focus of this particular solid waste plan is try to achieve our 61% solid waste reduction goal. Some of the activities of the last 4 years include developing a permanent electronics collection program, and I'm always hesitant to decide whether this is good or bad, but we are number one in the state of North Carolina in electronics recycled per capita. So the number of televisions, computers, cell phones, et cetera, that are being properly discarded is remarkable. And so we're able to get those back into circulation, or at least the materials. We initiated the state's unique regulated recyclable materials ordinance that bans cardboard, wood, and scrap metal from the landfill, and those get pushed into various recycling areas. And we passed the 3R fee several years ago, which has provided the recycling programs with a good source of funding. Several years ago, you all automated your solid waste collection in 90% of the town, except for the really dense parts that still require semi-automated collection. And when one thinks about the trade-offs, by automating collection and saving a full-time employee and being able to shift that to other duties, you've kind of squeezed the savings out of solid waste from an automation perspective. Do you want to save on collection, or do you want to save on disposal? So just to show a card from later, as you think about the notion of pay as you throw, frankly, it's a little contradictory with the notion of picking up a can automated and dumping it without being able to see if the cardboard bag is in there, if you will. So there was a savings here. It may or may not preclude a savings from choosing to go to pay as you throw without also having to go back and inspect the contents of the carts. Several years ago, we also added electronics recycling at the convenience centers. We initiated the work plan group, and we started collecting the 3R fee. 2 years ago, we expanded our hazardous waste collection. Once again, it led to more people coming with more hazardous waste. The construction waste landfill opened. It was initially predicted to last 13 years. With our rigorous enforcement of the ban on scrap metal, wood, and cardboard, we now think it'll last 20, and we continue to expand our recycling programs. Last year, we achieved our highest recycling rate ever. We were second highest in the state, and we continued to work on adding mixed paper, two-stream recycling, and the county with the Rogers Road neighborhood initiated a enhancement plan development and monitoring task force to ensure that the people who live near the landfill had some redress. This is just a snapshot of what's happened to waste over the last several years. And if you look in the first column where it says in-county landfill, that our landfill, you can see that's been mostly flat, and a certain amount of waste goes out of county. Overall, very little increase over the last 4 years in the amount of waste going to the landfill, commensurate with our waste reduction rate rising. Recycling is slowly creeping up. We are bumping our way towards meeting the goal. We're at that point on the curve, though, folks, where the easy gains have mostly been achieved, so the next ones will be a little harder. The notion of a planning, of a solid waste plan, encompasses these major elements: collection, disposal, recycling, reduction. And typically this is the way that we've done business, is that collection's been done by the governments predominantly, with a lot more involvement of the private sector the last few years. Once the LOG basically ceded the landfill to Orange County as a single entity, the county became responsible for disposal. We're statutorily obligated to provide disposal as a county government. That's one of the functions that we do. So whether it's a landfill or a transfer station, the county will be responsible for solid waste disposal. Recycling is predominantly a county function, but as I mentioned, UNC has a large role to play, and the private sector also is heavily involved, somewhat due to the cardboard ban and somewhat due to just the initiative of a lot of businesses hiring private companies to do recycling. As a county, we've led a lot of the waste reduction efforts. This is just a snapshot of the solid waste plan work group's work. And we've engaged on a number of issues. I just want to highlight a few things, recommendations that the work plan group has made. One of the things we've struggled with as a county over the last few years is, do we build our own materials recovery facility, or do we enable the private sector to process our recyclables? And the work plan group is recommending at this point that we consolidate recycling, and that the private sector, which has a relatively robust set of materials recovery facilities near us, be able to handle our recyclables. The magic number is about 18,000 tons, just to give you a little perspective. Our recycling program collects about 12,000 to 13,000 dry tons of recyclables.
The university has another 3,000. So we're a little bit short of the place where, according to our pro formas, we'd see a real benefit, a real definite economic benefit to having our own materials recovery facility. So by moving towards a commingling of recyclables and selling off our materials, we'll gain some experience with the private sector and buy some time to where we have to reengage on that decision, how to capitalize it, and so forth. I want to mention something about pay-as-you-throw, since it's been on and off everybody's agenda, particularly Carver and Chapel Hill over the last few years, which is that the work plan group did not come out with a recommendation regarding pay-as-you-throw, which is not to say it did not recommend it. Number one, it's a function of the individual local governments to decide how they want to handle their recyclables and or their garbage, and pay-as-you-throw is integrally linked to garbage. And number two, we do think that by the time I'm here a year from now, that'll definitely be part of whatever plan. We feel there's a certain obligation to address pay-as-you-throw, but the group as a collective did not come forward and say, we think everybody should do pay-as-you-throw, we think nobody should do it, we think this or that. If the town of Carver were to choose this, and I know that you've engaged on it earlier this year, you could, absent of any recommendation from the work group. Commercial franchise of solid waste was something that we looked at. If you just had one solid waste collector that collected all of the commercial solid waste, it would be more efficient, there'd be less pollution, we'd have more control than four or five or six private trucks and city trucks running around. But surprisingly, for the most part, it was not that cost effective to franchise against the current competitive rates. These are some of the issues that we'll be joining over the next few months. Convenience centers and solid waste and the recycling drop-off sites are hugely popular. About a third of our recycling comes there. Should we continue to do what we're doing? Should we close some of them? Are they highly functional? Should we improve them? How many should we have, and how should we pay for them? Just to go off a little bit on a tangent for a moment, if the town of Carver were to say $1.50 a bag for every bag of garbage, and the county didn't, they might trundle out to Ferguson Road or up to Eubanks Road to dump their garbage free, that is, as a part of the general fund. So when we have the pay-as-you-throw discussion, all this stuff is integrally linked. On commercial recycling, that's the only area that I'd say is still low-hanging fruit that's unplucked. It's a big area, and we'd have to figure out how to pay for it and what we should do. That is another issue that will be joined in this next year. This is not really that pertinent to Carver, so I'll sort of skip over rural residential waste collection, although it is important to note that if we're trying to achieve a carbon footprint reduction, running garbage, six or seven garbage trucks in the same area is less effective than one with a franchise. As we go forward, this is another indication that we haven't been inactive. Some of the things that we're actually going to talk to the county board about tonight that are in the manager's proposed budget, curbside cardboard, adding what we call mixed rigid plastics, whether they're buckets or big wheels or swimming pools or yogurt cups or whatever, for the drop-off sites, a ban on CRTs and televisions from the landfill commensurate with the new switch over to digital television. We think we'll see a huge slug of CRTs at the landfill, and whether you consider that a resource issue or a immediate environmental issue regarding the heavy metals and so on, we do propose a ban. We do expect over 1,000 more monitors and TVs than we're getting, and we have the capacity to handle it. Significantly, we're going to switch over the commercial and drop-off recycling to commingled from source separated. Those of you who use a drop-off site know it's a little bit of a pain to go around and put things in six different slots, so you'll only have to do either paper or cans and bottles, and that will enable us to improve our efficiency and expand commercial recycling. As another note, not insignificant regarding either the odor issues that are occurring around the landfill or carbon footprint we're trying to improve, is negotiating a landfill gas usage agreement with UNC that we hope will be completed in the next 60 days, and getting ready to finalize that. The long-term plan, as I mentioned when I'm standing here a year from now, these issues will all be clarified, and some decisions will be made, recommendations for you to all address around how to pay for the various services that we think we want, like commercial recycling. Should we try to ban our way towards 61%? Should we ban the heck out of a whole array of materials? Is that appropriate, the same way we've banned cardboard and wood and scrap metal? What other regulatory approaches should we use? And organic materials management is a not insignificant issue. About 20% of our materials are food waste and other organics that could be handled other than being landfilled, and yet it's a huge capital expense, and it's a real change in the way we do business. Adding more materials, switching to carts, pay as you throw, and I do want to just highlight that the transfer station issue is being handled on a whole separate planning track. It's integral to the notion of an integrated plan. The Board of Commissioners has said they are handling that directly. And in fact, Gail just told me earlier that they adopted the exclusionary criteria tonight, so they are moving forward. Their timetable is to make a decision this fall.
What does the exclusionary criteria mean?
Places where they're not going to put a transfer station.
Was Eubanks on that?
I'm sorry?
Was Eubanks Road on that?
I don't know. Do you know the answer to that?
Eubanks Road was not excluded yet.
Not at this point.
Okay.
Oh, because of the legal issues?
You'll have to call your county commissioner.
Exactly.
All right. Anyway, yes? Go right ahead.
So we're here to take your comments, and we're here to ask you to ask for your endorsement of the plan. As I mentioned, it's two things are important. One is it doesn't obligate the town financially or policy-wise, and secondly, it does put us in a position to apply for grants and come into compliance as we proceed with our solid waste planning work. And happy to take any questions from you all.
I have a quick question. On the MRF, you said that that we're short, what is it, maybe, you said 18,000 tons was the tonnage?
That's kind of a magic number, according to the consultants that we've used, that that's where the economics of owning and operating your own facility start to, you know, make sense, if you will, versus the capital investment, versus the notion of traveling 30 miles with your materials. And it's not an insignificant capital investment. We don't really have the tonnage yet to justify that kind of equipment.
And with the numbers you gave, at least I'm looking here, is that UNC is about 3,000 tons. What do you think will be generated from Carolina North? And that's part one of the question. The second part is, would at some point, with the addition of Carolina North and 20,000 either jobs or residential mixed use of the space of Carolina North, would we be in a position to create a MRF here?
Well, from a volume, this is just strictly, when I use that that number of 18,000 tons, I'm harking back to the study, and Carolina North, that 20,000 target was like a 50-year build-out, so I don't know where those things intersect, you know, how hard we use our own tools of regulation and economic incentives and so on to squeeze the current waste stream to push ourselves forward, how much we wait and so on. But the key point on this, Randy, I think, is that by adopting this strategy to commingle our recyclables and shipping out, we buy ourselves a few years to kind of see what it's like working with the private sector and see if it's cost-effective for us. 2 years ago, they wouldn't have given us a thing for commingled cans and bottles, and last month, one of the potential MRFs offered us $13 a ton for all the mixed cans and bottles, and the other guy said, how's 40 or 50 sound to you? So as the prices get better, right, it's sort of a horse race as to whether it makes sense for us to build this thing or continue to use the private sector.
Thank you. Good.
We can always reconsider using the private sector. We can't necessarily reconsider later on having built our own facilities.
Yeah, if we spend $5 million on a facility, we're kind of married to it.
Yeah, just sort of two follow-up questions. On an earlier slide, you had indicated the amount of waste that you thought was going out of county, which was an estimate.
Those are the numbers that are reported to us from the state. The okay. way the state law is set up is that everybody who every truck that comes across a scale, say, at the transfer station by the airport or Durham's transfer station, what have you, has to declare. So those guys will write down, declared Orange County, yeah, okay. declared Alamance County. So they're not our numbers. And frankly, you know, I'll say to you that we know from the reports of some of the local private solid waste haulers that go to Durham, we saw nothing in our state solid waste study this year that said 1,400 tons of this guy's waste went to Durham. And yet he said to me, oh, I took everything to Durham. So it's probably underreported.
Okay.
Yeah, a couple of things. First, I think this is a very good plan, and thank you for the work. I think it's good progress shown in it for the coming year and good questions being asked in terms of getting on course for the future. I want to make sure you knew that a year ago we had a discussion about waste reduction efforts that we could do within Carrboro, and we at that time agreed to three projects that we undertook. One was a public education project. One was more recycling opportunities in our parks. And the third was to seek a grant for residential composting, which we did not get. But anyway, I'm telling you all that just so you know that we're interested in moving forward on reduction. So if things come up in your office that you could pass on to us or that we can participate in, or, you know, do let us know. And the final thing I have is just a question whether you have a target date yet for the curbside cardboard pickup.
Well, thanks for that feedback, Dan. The if the county commissioners pass the manager's recommended budget next month, I think mid-fall is a realistic time for the cardboard at the curb. And at that time, we, frankly, we'll probably come back to you and engage you in a discussion about how we can get people to cut down their cardboard to meet the cut-down requirements and whether you all want to engage in a residential cardboard ban to couple with the fact that the opportunity is there.
Thanks.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a follow-up about the televisions and the CRTs not being accepted at the landfill anymore. I just want to be clear. Will they be recyclable anymore or not at the landfill anymore or neither or both? Or
they'll be handled the way that we handle the CRTs and televisions, and those will be tube-based televisions, not flat-screen TVs. Those aren't quite coming out of circulation
right.
yet. But right now, the way that we handle televisions and computer CRTs is that we send them off for predominantly recycling. Some of them are actually rebuilt. The buyers on the other end make a determination whether they're rebuildable or need to be the materials extracted from them. So any TVs that we get will be sent off for either reuse or predominantly recycling.
Okay, good. The recycling part just continues. I just wanted to be clear on that.
Right, great. Right. And, in fact, this part of our recommended budget as well, because there is a right now, of all the items that we take in for electronics recycling, those are the things that still have a significant cost attached to them. The economics of other things like CPUs have flipped over to where we're actually getting paid a couple of cents a pound. Mm. Yes, ma'am.
They're related. When we are recycling the electronics, do we know where that recycling is actually happening, where the disassembling is actually happening?
We deal with a company in Mayo, Dan, North Carolina, up in Rockingham County called Synergy, and they do some of the work there. Their due diligence, well, we know what happens there. I mean, we've been up there, and part of the reason we selected them was because we saw the work that was done there, and we examined it and found it satisfactory. Their downstream due diligence is kind of up to them, and their report to us is that the companies that they're doing business with, some domestic and some overseas, are legitimate.
Okay, I guess my concern is
that's as far as we've taken it.
In our little bubble, we're always so careful about doing things right, both environmentally and socially, and sometimes what we do spills out of our bubble. And I want to make sure we're controlling that as much as possible. I mean, we're all aware of some of the horror stories in other countries, particularly in India and China and Vietnam, where people are taking things apart, and both the human degradation and the environmental degradation. I think we need to be very careful that we're not contributing to that. Which brings me to my other point, that when we are looking at maybe franchising out some of the MSW, if we're looking at not doing that ourselves, I think we need to be very careful there too, and that whoever we contract with has the same
labor values.
Has the same labor values that we do, and that we're not saving money at the expense of working people. So those are two ways that I see what we do affecting people that are outside of our sphere, but we still have a responsibility to act and spend responsibly.
I think if I could address that for a moment, those are both subjects that I know have come up in our solid waste planning efforts what is the name of the committee I serve?
Solid Waste Plan Work Group.
Solid Waste Planning Work Group. Anyway, those are definitely both of those are points that we've had some discussion about, and particularly actually as it related to the question of MRFs and whether you would have one run by a county or built run working with private sector companies, and also about the trucking, you know, who would drive the trucks and who they work for and what conditions are. So I think it's an issue that we're looking at, but I hadn't heard actually specifically about the electronics, you all having visited that site. That's good to hear.
Well, let me respond a little bit, if I might. When we selected the particular electronics recycling company that we're dealing with, we made several site visits to companies around North Carolina that were interested in the company that exhibited on their site the highest level of environmental compliance and so on. That was a major criterion, and what they were able to tell us about their downstream, if you want to call it a supply chain, a distribution chain, was it met our criteria. They are ISO, I think it's 14,000 certified, which means that there was a third party that looked at their environmental chain and found it acceptable. Now, as far as every single last thing, no, I can't tell you with 100% certainty, but as far as our due diligence, we feel like we did a significantly good job, and we didn't go with the low bid, but rather with the people that we thought.
And you looked at labor as well as environmental conditions?
In the plant, yeah. The plant seemed to meet a reasonable environmental standard. We didn't have a particular standard, but frankly, subjective criteria were, we went to a couple of places that were disastrous looking with, you know, rain falling in on them and literally junkyard dogs prowling around and so on, and we decided not to do business with them. Generally, a clean job site is a safe job site, and that was reflected in our selection process. As far as franchise of waste hauling, let me say just a few things about that. One is that's an open discussion right now. Two is that any waste, from the standpoint of the disposition of the material, our intent, if a franchise were selected as the way to handle things, it would direct all waste to our facility, so we'd have a lot of oversight over the material. And as far as the way that the company worked with respect to the wages they pay and other issues, those, frankly, in our contracting have not been things that we've made selection criteria. However, if the solid waste plan work groups wants to recommend that those become part of the selection criteria, then, you know, we're going
to
listen.
I'd like to encourage them to, because I'm not interested in our saving money at the expense of people at the lower end of the economic ladder. Just not interested in that.
Okay. Well, you all, as the guiding forces in the county, will set the criteria for selecting.
I can count on Mark to
represent
that.
We'll bring it forward. Absolutely.
I would also like to recognize Albert Vickers has joined us. He is one of our representatives to the Solid Waste Advisory Board, and is a part of the Solid Waste Management Plan Work Group, or whatever it's called. And also Linda Bowerman is, I believe, our other representative from the town of Harbor.
Right. They've been integrally involved in all these discussions about development of the plan.
All right. So is there, do we have a resolution?
Yeah, I'll move resolution.
Second.
Okay. The resolution's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passed unanimously.
So, thank you, Blair. And now that you're married, do you still the same last name?
Yeah, sorry to disappoint you. She took my last name.
Ah, married younger. Congratulations.
Isn't that the truth?
Somebody finally saw the virtues of Blair Powell.
Congratulations.
And Gail Wilson is also with us here tonight. Thank you for all your work as well.
Yeah.
All right. With that, item D4, an update on Jordan Lake rules.
As you all know, over the past several years, the town and Triangle J Council of Government staff have updated the board several times on the proposed rules to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus inputs to Jordan Lake. The purpose of this agenda item is to provide an update on the status of rulemaking subsequent to public hearings held in 2007 and the resulting State Division of Water Quality and Environmental Management Commission deliberations. And Randy Dodd, our environmental planner, is before you to give a presentation. Randy.
So there's an awful lot that's been going on with Jordan Lake. This is going to be the abridged or highly annotated version, short version. There's plenty of more for those who are interested to look at. All of it's online, and there's some other details in your packet tonight. But we just want to keep you updated on what's going on and give you a little heads up for things we'll be thinking about in the future and receive any feedback that you may have to help us in thinking about this. Jordan Lake Watershed, it's a large watshed. It's the upper Cape Fear River Basin. If you look down here at the whoop.
Is this window?
That was the wrong button.
Well, that ends that presentation.
Man, that was quick.
We just rescued you.
Thank you, Jordan.
That was the footnote. Simpson Street traffic call. Well, like you said, without PowerPoint, just the local government
just go home.
Yeah. Grind to all.
Oops.
All right. There we go. Time is running out.
It should pop back to the computer screen in a
second. So what we're going to see when we come back up
that is a project.
Don't let him have that.
Thank God we've got somebody under 40 on staff.
Thank
all right.
You, well, here's a beautiful Panasonic. But while it's pulling up, I'll just start talking about what I'll be talking about in the Jordan Lake situation. The watershed itself, well, here we go. It's a large watershed. We're located down here near Jordan Lake in what is known as the New Hope Creek or New Hope River branch, this large branch of Jordan Lake. In addition to the New Hope River flowing into Jordan Lake, the Haw River comes all the way up from north of Greensboro through Piedmont Triad, including Burlington and Graham. We're looking at here also various watershed, water supply watershed designations. So a good deal of the Jordan watershed does serve as water supply for various communities. And has some protections associated with it, but you can also see there's large portions of it that, while they do drain to Jordan Lake, which is recognized as a water supply watershed, they don't have all of their land area in the watershed with these types of protections. This is the Jordan Lake water supply watershed boundary for land area that actually has those restrictions included. So that's just a briefest of overviews of the geography we're looking at here when we think about these rules. In terms of the history, actually consideration of these kinds of issues goes back into the 1940s. While the lake was in its early phases of being considered for impoundment. In 1983, the most significant action to date from a regulatory perspective looking at nutrients, and when I say nutrients, I'm talking about nitrogen and phosphorus as the things we're concerned about. 1983, the state designated Jordan Lake as what is known as a nutrient-sensitive water, so it was recognition there was a problem. And these rules kicked in primarily for phosphorus from wastewater treatment plants. Over the years, there's been additional regulations considered. Beginning in 97, the Clean Water Responsibility Act, House Bill 515, is, as it's most commonly referred to. And it, this required controls on nitrogen as well from wastewater treatment plants. And in addition, it set the stage for an ability for local governments to do some technical studies, what we refer to here as a nutrient response model. This is a mathematical model that describes the behavior of the lake to justify alternative limits. And so subsequently, a nutrient response model was developed by Tetra Tech, a private firm. A lot of the work behind this was coordinated by Triangle J, Council of Governments. It included both a hydrodynamic model. This is a model that describes in very detailed fashion the dynamics of the water movement through the lake, very complex situation, as well as water quality, which looks more at the chemistry and the biology of the lake. And so conditions were simulated with this model for what has been adopted as a baseline condition from 1997 to 2001. So that's our starting point for consideration of any kind of future changes. And this models both the nitrogen and phosphorus as well as the response of the lake in terms of algae. Algae is the primary thing we're looking at, is too much algae growing in the lake. A stakeholder project has been pursued with 19 local governments, 14 state and federal agencies, 11 NGOs, facilitated by the Regional Council of Governments. All sorts of information out there on the web to talk about this, not only the technical aspect that was involved in this modeling, but in terms of the coming to some kind of consensus or process for considering regulations. One significant regulatory action that was taken was that EPA actually developed what is known as a total maximum daily load. This is a requirement for doing something about the excess of nutrients. It was originally proposed much before the date of this report, but it was actually approved by EPA subsequent to the July 2007 public hearings. This is dated September 20th, 2007. There was a draft one prior to that, and the final and the draft don't have any significant deviations from each other. And basically, this TMDL requires for the upper New Hope arm, this is above Farrington Road, the upper portions of the New Hope arm of Jordan Lake, a nitrogen reduction of 35% and a phosphorus reduction of 5%. It's the most stringent, the largest requirements for reductions. And in the Haw River arm, down closer to the dam, much less stringent requirements, 8% for nitrogen and 5% for phosphorus. So this is what's driving EPA's interest, and the state's also bound to be compliant with EPA's interests, and so the state has its own interest as well as the TMDL to consider. The Environmental Management Commission has considered a series of about a dozen new rules. These have been in the books for several years now, and they have, through this last round of public hearings, there have been some changes proposed. The ones that are shown in yellow are the ones that it seems are most likely to have some impact to the town, stormwater management for new development, existing development. Arguably the most substantial of all, this would require some retrofitting, as well as protection of existing riparian buffers and some options for offsetting nutrient loads. And if anyone's interested in what that involves, I'd be happy to answer any questions. The most important thing from this latest round of public hearings is the Environmental Management Commission essentially endorsed the previous proposed rules and made some minor modifications, relatively minor modifications. They basically retained the basic content as taken to public comment, and they sought to maximize options to make the rules as cost-effective and bearable as possible. Continuing of their findings, they accept the technical study recommendations. They affirm that these rules are within their statutory authority. They affirm that the rules address both existing and new development, recognize their value of offset and market-based trading options included in the rules, recognize concerns over new costs imposed on local governments, and emphasize that the original cost estimates that the State Division of Water Quality staff included in their fiscal impact were considered as an avoidable worst-case scenario. And most notably, I think, they included in their findings a request to the General Assembly for funding from local governments. I believe I included in your written materials the amount of that is $100 million. I've got a little bit more specific information that they are, the Commission is requesting a $10 million recurring appropriation to assist local governments in meeting the requirements of the existing development stormwater rule, and a $1 million recurring appropriation to assist local governments with staffing and other resource needs to implement the requirements of the riparian buffer protection and new development stormwater rules. So some modifications from the last time around with these rules. The rules recognize the uncertainties and the long-term effort involved. The local governments would therefore be required to meet half of their reductions within 10 years or propose an alternative along with supporting technical analysis. So this is a little bit additional detail provided. There's also a monitoring option that will allow for the targeting of those catchments, those small watersheds that are particularly high sources of nutrients. And it also allows for additional alternative practices such as source control of pet waste and fertilizer, stormwater capture and reuse, stream and buffer restoration, and use of private credit generation. So there's additional management measures that are considered to be okay to consider in pursuing these regulations. Nutrient management, this basically refers to the application of fertilizer. And for this is a change from the last round of the rules. The compliance date and hired applicator threshold tightened from 5 to 3 years and 10 to 5 acres, respectively, for these rules.
So, wait a minute. Can we go back over that? So that still wouldn't cover your average suburban or urban yard.
That's correct.
It still wouldn't. Right. And just we don't have many 5-acre yards here. That's disappointing, and I don't think Raleigh has many 5-acre yards or anybody does. So it's really letting the individual homeowner, who I think is one of the biggest offenders, totally off the hook. And my bet would be that the pressure to do that is coming from the business sector more than it is the homeowner sector. So I think that's something that we still need to be working on and to not just, you know, quietly go into the night on that one. I won't.
That.
In terms of the state's fiscal analysis, just a couple of notes here. Their annual cost range for existing development in lieu of the earlier worst case, they redid their fiscal analysis to try to be responsive to some of the comments. And in their original version, they assumed that structural reason they characterize this as sort of worst case is they assumed that structural stormwater retrofits and land purchase would be required as part of the retrofit process. And
can I ask you a question about that? So were they in terms of were they talking about the particular residential owner or the particular commercial owner? If they bought a property, then they would have to, I guess.
You're talking about you.
Okay.
Yeah, local government doing it, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I see. Well, you know, that's why I asked the question.
That's why you asked.
That's
why it's an important question.
It's huge.
So the DWQ staff do expect that implementation, in all reality, when all the flexibility and possibilities play out, that it could be significantly less costly than this
right.
Worst
or
case.
More.
Right.
Right. Sorry, I don't believe that. But.
Yeah, make sure that's the DWQ staff's take on this.
Not mine.
How is it going to impact Carver? Well, it's this is a very large consideration, and it's hard to at this point be crystal clear on this. It is clear that the state is expecting steady long-term progress in reducing nutrients, and the required date for beginning to show some progress is about 3 to 4 years out.
Okay.
We would likely have to revise several sections of our land use ordinance. We actually last summer had brought some possibilities to you and at that point put those on hold, waiting to see how this all played out.
Mm-hmm.
It would be clear there would be a requirement for retrofitting for existing development, mm-hmm. and there is going to be a fiscal impact. Exactly mm-hmm. the magnitude of that, I think it's a little bit
pretty pricey.
Premature to be specific about, but it could be substantial. So the next steps in the state's process, the Rules Review Commission is going to review the EMC's recommendations. June 19th is the date that's set for. And if that moves forward, then these rules could become effective in 2009.
Could I just make a statement about that? If 10 separate people or entities object to the rules, then the rules are put to a vote to the entire General Assembly.
Okay.
So even if the Rules Review Commission, having gone through the rule-making process 3 times with lobbying rules, if someone objects, well, if 10 separate entities object or people, then it goes to the General Assembly when they next meet for a vote. So,
okay.
So it could be longer than 2009.
That's exactly right.
Great to make that happen.
Just to let you know.
And in terms of staff, our suggestion is that we continue to monitor the development of these rules over the next few months and continue to do our homework and come back to you sometime in the fall or winter with more detailed reports and detailing the impacts and outlining some implementation options for consideration.
If my memory is correct, when we discussed this previously a couple of months ago, there was no indication of how is the state going to determine whether or not we made a 35% reduction, or is it going to be the I thought it was the region as a whole.
In other words, whether the town would be required to meet that.
Right.
My interpretation is that these rules apply to all lands and all development.
Right.
And so there are provisions included in here for what's known as offsetting.
Right.
And in that scenario, if on a particular parcel or project that the limits couldn't be met, there would be a possibility for paying into an offset fund that could then be applied on another site.
Right.
The exact details of the geography of that, I think, are to be determined. Nobody, you know, in this whole trading idea is also proposed to encourage flexibility and consideration. But so the New Hope River requirement for 35% reduction, that is set in stone. Whether every single project needs to meet the same stormwater requirements, is going to be a function of how this plays out in terms of the right. implementation mm-hmm. of the offset and the trading requirements.
I guess it's more of a technical question to me. How would they really know that we are reducing 35% and some other local government is not? I mean, I guess where is the...
How are they measuring?
How are they measuring
qualifies.
Compliance?
There are technical tools for actually doing these calculations. They've developed them in some other river basins mm-hmm. that they are suggesting as the tools.
But are they going to do those kinds of measurements, you know, down at Jordan Lake in the Upper Du Hoc Arm, or are they going to take both. Sampling all along the creeks and so forth?
Well, there's a variety of levels of checking here. There are monitoring sites at various locations along the creek that will continue to be monitored. They're going to encourage either the state will put in or they will encourage local governments to help support additional monitoring sites. And then there's also sort of site-level tools to look at calculations based on the type of development and the activity to look at the loading rates
right.
on individual sites. So there's multiple levels of sort of compliance, if you will, or monitoring.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about that. In my mind, I'm thinking one thing when you say New Hope River. Do you mean the same river creek that runs through Duke's Forest? Okay, that goes down to 15501?
It starts as New Hope Creek, and then
right.
when it gets below Little Creek, then it becomes New Hope River.
Okay, because interestingly enough, I spent 6 hours on that creek with students on Friday water testing and doing a lot of the samples tests, and everything looked very, very good. It was flooded at the time, but it looked very good. But I know there's serious concerns from 15501 south, and I think getting back to Joel's point, you know, do you feel that the Department of Water Quality, you know, the technological material that they're using to assess would be able to distinguish what belongs to whom?
Yeah, because, you know, there's a difference when you have a rule that says we only going to allow 40% open space when you develop the residential. And you're just a messenger, so you're not. As opposed to some other jurisdictions that don't have that limit. So they have more, in some places, more intensive
right.
development, which creates more runoff, more phosphorus, more nitrogen discharge.
Plus, there's clearly less reparation done on large segments of that creek and river.
I guess part of the response is that where there's been more impairment, if you will, or more, there's a larger problem.
Right.
There'll be a larger retrofit that has to be pursued.
Okay. As long as we're not paying for it.
Some areas are going to, you know, percentage.
Can I just add one comment to that? Yeah. Brandon just said all the meetings we had last year about the stakeholders, and he wasn't working with us then, but the folks from DWQ did. Mm-hmm. They have not yet finalized how they will, you know, determine compliance with the loading limits. But what they have told us is that they'll basically, using the data that they've collected, they'll be creating baselines for all of the communities. And then our reporting requirements to them, which I think are going to be on an annual basis, are going to involve, you know, the town documenting with regard to new projects how we have shown, how we're meeting the whatever the nitrogen and phosphorus limits become, you know, the acreages of the projects and that is the calculations that Randy's referencing in terms of the stormwater management structures and so forth that are included in projects. And then for existing, you know, retrofitting for the existing development, we'll need to show acreages of
of treatment, land areas that have been and structures that are put in place to treat those and meet and show that we're meeting the nitrogen and phosphorus limits. So they're proposing a reporting strategy, and that will be used in combination with the data sites that they have in the lake and so forth. So it's an interesting. They have not finalized the process yet, and it's been an interesting discussion with the DWQ staff as to how we would know that we were complying from our perspective, and that they concurred with us. So,
what happens if we don't comply?
Well, I think that we have. I mean, there's built into this process a couple of years for us to figure out how we intend to comply, and then. And then there's also built into this process some changes in what's called a nutrient management strategy. So down the road, figuring out, continuing to monitor the problem in the lake and see what's changing. There's an atmospheric nitrogen component to it that's also going to be modeled. So it's something of a moving target, if you would maybe agree with that. But I think that there'll be a way for us to determine what we think we've done when we know what the rules are absolutely going to be and how it's going to affect us, and we'll know whether they agree with us. And then I don't know I'm not sure I know what the penalty piece is if we're not complying, but Randy's probably got that detail. Anyway, I don't know if that helps, but that's what they've proposed so far in terms of the reporting.
Somewhat.
Let me just add one thing. My understanding is, I think where you're going, Joel, is what makes sense is if you basically sort of dip into the water and you say, this is where we are, and you measure it, and then you do these things, and you measure it again. That isn't what's happening.
Right.
It's all indirect. It's all modeling. It's all based upon assumption, built upon assumption, built upon assumption.
Right.
And the end result is you're told you have to do, the regulations are going to require us to do a certain percentage loading, 0.2 pounds
right.
per year of nitrogen or something, and there's ways to figure out whether, that's going to be the standard. And the assumption is that everybody does that, it's going to make a difference. Nobody knows whether it is or not, but that's the assumption, and you've got this rule that you have to comply with. So it's sort of an indirect measure. You get credit for complying with the requirement. You have I don't think anybody really has any idea whether it's going to do anything or not.
Jeez.
So, that's my reaction exactly. It's going to be very, very expensive based upon an awful lot of assumptions and with very uncertain results and almost no way to parse it out. You can't tell what's coming off, Carrboro as opposed to
right.
Chapel Hill. It just all gets mixed together. And it's a nightmare.
Jackie, if I can jump in for one second, just so that the public or people who are listening at home are clear on what it means to do something, what we may be asked to do is for example, the town of Carrboro to buy a piece of property or use a piece of property that we already own to build some type of detention pond or storm scepter or these different kinds of devices that would slow down stormwater running off of various developed parts of our town, just as new developments are required to do, but we would be required to basically retrofit already developed areas of town. And, as a practical matter, the question is, where would the actual devices be, or what pieces of land would you put them on? Because, very few pieces of property that the town currently owns that might even be feasible to do this on, and it becomes and then it costs a bunch of money to actually build the detention devices devices as well. So it does present some interesting questions.
I'd like to get this in the record, and I'd like to ask the board to consider it further down the road. I suggest that we try and start a movement here in Carrboro where we could get all of the affected municipalities together, all the affected governments together, to request permission from the state to have a surcharge on the nutrients and phosphates that are sold in this area, not just in Carrboro, but in the whole area, in order to finance the cost of cleaning up after them. Mm-hmm. So, and so I don't, don't know
like
how
far. Like a fertilizer tax or that.
Right. A fertilizer tax. And, you know, if people are using it and if companies are making money off of it, then by golly, they should have to pay for, you know, I think you should have to pay for the whole of what you're costing. So, you know, it could be another one of those things where people go, oh, geez, Carborough, but then, you know, if we could get everybody to sign on to it and the state give us permission, because we're really being asked to bear the financial burden that's being put on us from many different things that are beyond our control. So let's have it paid for by the people that are using it and by the people who are profiting from its use.
Yeah, maybe we could ask our Triangle J rep to talk to the Triangle J chair, who I think lives up near Hillsboro. And, you know, that seems like an appropriate forum to bring that up without us having to, like, communicate.
Right. But I would like for this idea not to get lost. So mm-hmm. often we come up with things. So I really want it in the record, and I would like to ask that it be put on the agenda as a full discussion item sometime relatively soon so we can strategize it.
I just want to ask Randy a question to, based on what Dan just said. It's my understanding that the Cape Fear River Basin doesn't go up to, like, Hillsborough and Northern Orange. Is that correct? It's the Neuse.
Yes.
Eno is the Neuse.
The Eno River goes into the Neuse.
Yeah.
So,
so we'd have to look very carefully at, you know, who are the real affected stakeholders to follow up on Jackie's, not assume Northern Orange, you know, is going to be, you know, interested
in this. There are similar regulations for the Falls of the Neuse reservoir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was going to say, this process is going on in other parts of
right.
the
so it's not just for Jordan, it's for other things.
Right, so the very specific Cape Fear folks.
Well, I suggest to Triangle J, because they're already lead agency.
Mm-hmm. Right. But what's different for Jordan is the retrofit.
Yeah.
I see.
That's what's different. That's what's unique about this place that they're saying. And that obviously, it's one thing to adopt rules and regulations and say all new development must do thus and so. They typically and historically the regulations have been getting tighter and tighter.
Right.
It's another thing entirely to say, and now you've got to go back and retrofit, and the U is going to be the municipality, which means everybody. That's what's different about these set of regulations.
Including, curiously, people who may move, I mean, you know, not to belabor the point, but if you move into a brand new development where you're essentially paying for storm scepters and whatever the developer has put in, but then you're paying your municipal taxes as well, then you're, you know, mm-hmm. you're helping to finance a solution to problems that are created by neighborhoods that you don't live in, such as mine. And, you know, so it's a... It's always
all kinds
social
of
equity
inequities in this. Yeah.
All right.
I have one other comment.
Yes.
And that is, I wanted to publicly acknowledge Randy and the award he received that was beautifully reported in the news. So we know that this project is in good hands and that you're up to the task. And with that, I'll move the acceptance of the report.
Second.
All right. Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
The matter passes unanimously.
You want to make a different option? Jackie?
Not okay.
Simpson Street traffic calming request.
The Simpson Street residents have requested traffic calming for the segment between Main Street and Phipps Street. Staff has reviewed the request and collected data as prescribed by the Residential Traffic Management Plan, and a resolution is attached for your consideration, and Adina Messinger has a report on this item. Adina?
Let me ask the board whether we require a...
We don't.
No,
are there
residents? We don't enjoy your presentation.
Are there people? Well, are there people here who have come to speak about the problem on Simpson Street?
Or to speak,
depends on whether we're going to pass the resolution or not, right?
Sure. We'll discuss it more later.
Okay.
We're here in support of the resolution.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I move that we
support the
Second.
Resolution.
Second.
Good report, Adina.
Resolution A has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the matter passed unanimously. All right. Congratulations. Let us know how it goes. We'll see you later.
Enjoy your home day.
The Rhett, I was contacted. I think I forwarded to y'all an email from folks on Oak Avenue requesting that we put this Oak Avenue follow-up report off to a later date when they can have a little bit more of a chance to think about how they want to respond. Mr. Manager, could you report back to us sometime soon when specifically you would like to have that on the agenda, on a future agenda, so that we can let the folks on Oak Avenue know when to expect it?
Yes, sir, and would it be appropriate for us to contact them to see when they're going to be ready, because they had asked for the delay so they would have an opportunity to review the staff report in more detail.
I think the indication I got was they didn't necessarily need a whole lot of time, but I think the problem becomes that we don't have a whole lot of meetings between now and the end of June when there's space on our schedule. So, yeah, if you'll be in touch with them about that, that would be great. All right. We'll move to item D7, annual report on National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System stormwater permit.
All right. This is Randy Dodd again to give a report on the NPDES program. There are a number of requirements that are required by the town, and there's a resolution accepting staff recommendations and also setting a public hearing date to consider some of the changes in our ordinances. So, Randy?
We had a presentation on this general issue, I think, a month or so ago.
Yeah, I'll jump back to the point.
Okay. See if you can be as quick as Adina.
That's a tough one.
Well, thank you, Randy.
So we have an NPDES Phase 2 permit. We're in year 3. We have some things we have to do by June 30th of this year. Not going to talk about all the things that we don't have to do, but the two starred ones, illicit discharge detection elimination and post-construction stormwater management. Four different items. We have proposed town code amendment looking at actually a second point here, establish and maintain adequate legal authorities, and we have a proposed town code amendment that's included in your packet to help us do this, and then we also have a requirement to set up a program to implement this requirement, and we have posted on our website a program plan telling how we're going to implement this program as well. So that's one piece. I can entertain questions or go into more detail. Keep going. These are things we consider as illicit discharges. These are all the bad things. Won't go into details about those. And then in our draft town code amendment, these are things that we don't consider to be illicit discharges. I'll just let you all take a look at those real quick.
Okay.
So we've had some discussion about car wash, and that's been sort of the most interesting one for us to consider. And the way it's worded is, see if I can find it exactly here. If you look, well, it says individual residential car washing or charity car washing is not considered to be an illicit discharge, but it would presumably commercial car washing would be still, if there was some issue associated with commercial car washing, that would be something we'd be concerned about.
Okay.
So that's the illicit discharge piece. The other thing we have to look at stems from our discussion we just finished with Jordan Lake and the fact that it was identified as nutrient-sensitive waters in 1983. So we need to look at two things associated with that. One is that when we now look at BMPs in our development review process for new development, we don't have anything specifically that helps us steer the selection of BMPs to ones that are more effective for nutrients. So we have some draft language to help us along those lines. And we also have a town code amendment to help us look at the oversight of fertilizer application. We still have the 5-acre requirement. We haven't tried to go smaller than that in this particular piece. And basically what that does is requires anyone who's applying fertilizer defined as either commercial fertilizer, compost, or biosolids on 5 acres or more to have either have appropriate training, or if they don't, then they have to develop a plan to show that they're properly applying fertilizer.
So if it's subdivided, we will not be doing the oversight of the application.
When you say it's
subdivided. For example, for a subdivision that starts out as 10 acres in its entirety and the 10 acres is divided in, I don't know, how many houses you can get on an acre.
If the application isn't happening on a 5-acre or more site,
okay,
then okay, this wouldn't apply.
Once it's, yeah, basically once it's developed, it's not going
to
be.
Or but that's divided. Likely to be like, as the manager's pointed out, some homeowners associations may well have 5 acres of common ground that they maintain because we have 40% open space requirements. But that, I mean, they may have the open spaces, but if they're not landscaped and fertilizer, then
right,
then
right,
apply.
Right.
Probably is going to apply to, probably most notably to the town of Carville because we maintain, you know, roadways.
Right.
And then the school system, and recreation fields, things like that.
Mm. Okay.
Okay.
So with the piece about requiring prioritization of BMPs, this is actually one we would need to set a public hearing for as a land use ordinance.
Okay.
Amendment. And we have in our draft recommendation, we would set that date for June 24th.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Move to accept the Pest Management Resolution.
Second.
The resolution A has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Thanks, Randy. And then agenda item 8, appointments to local living economy task force.
Mark,
Lydia.
I move that we appoint Randy and Dan to the local living economy task force.
Second that.
All right. It's been moved and seconded that we appoint. There's two Board of Aldermen positions, is that it?
Correct.
Okay. Then moved and seconded that we appoint Randy and Dan to the task force. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously.
Thank you all. And I'd like to make a motion for the citizens. I move.
Are you saying citizens at large or?
Well, I'm going to include business and at large.
Okay.
For business, Robert Dixon, Victor Jimenez, and Jennifer McMillan, and for at-large, Margot Lester, Sammy Slade, and Chuck Willingham.
Second.
Hold on, let me make sure I get that. Dixon, Jimenez,
Jenny.
And McMillan.
Jenny McMillan.
That's business.
And then the at-large positions,
Lester, Slade, and Willingham. And those could actually be cut differently because I think 5 of those 6 are actually
business. Some of those people are actually business people.
Business,
some of the at-large are actually business people.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Could we just, well, I was thinking that Janice Glass might be good because of her connection to Durham Tech, and we may want that educational view.
I think that's, when I was reviewing it and I did like a ledger, I was very interested in that, but I think that's going to come in at the next level. This task force is really based on, you know, those people very locally getting a good sense of what we're looking for.
Yeah, I talked to James about this because there's also someone at Central Carolina Community College who's interested in the task force. And basically thinking that they can observe and that they can also be called in as resources.
Without necessarily being on the committee.
Exactly.
Okay, so the motion is Dixon, Jimenez, and McMillan for the business owner positions and Lester Slade and Willingham for the at-large positions. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. All right.
Economic Sustainability Commission members will be those recommended.
Yes.
Right. Do we need a motion for those?
Let's hear it real quick.
Yeah. Move Gary Kramling and Peter Lee for
second.
The ESC
members.
It's been moved and seconded. Kramling and Lee, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passed unanimously. Does the town staff have any items to bring up? Okay.
Are we out of here?
Board member?
I have one real quick follow-up to last week. We had said that we would find a way to work on getting information about the Homestead Act exemption and the increase in the Homestead Act exemption out to our senior citizens. How's that coming?
I know we've made some contact with the county, but I don't think we've come up with a real good way because it's really a county function, and they're the ones who sign off on it. Being, I don't know if Joe Robertson has come up with any better way to get the information out.
Could we, sometime before the end of this fiscal year, have like some recommendations for how we can get that information to our Carborough citizens that qualify for it? Because I think, particularly with the budget that's facing us, and we hear more and more from elderly people on fixed incomes that they can't afford to stay here, and since that exemption has increased, I have found out that you don't just automatically get it. You have to apply for it.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of people that aren't applying for it. Let's, I don't care if it's the county responsibility. There are folks. Let's find a way of getting that information out to our folks so they can benefit. We could even help them apply for it. Maybe we could use RSVP or one of those groups that helps seniors with tax issues, or work with the senior center and encourage them to have a day when they help all the people who are qualified for it apply for it. I think given what we may have to do in our budget, it's really important.
Jackie, I'm wondering if you might be willing to contact the three newspaper editors and encourage them to write a story on that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I will if you'll remind me.
Who they are.
I know who they are. Like I'm making
email
myself,
her in the morning.
Yeah, email me in the morning.
Yes,
I will be happy to
do it. If someone emails
me
to remind you, I will email.
I know. Who's under 40?
I'll ask Sean to do that.
Yes, ma'am.
Could staff check with the North Carolina Housing Finance Agency the closest counselors for their prevention of foreclosure? They have a program about the prevention of foreclosure, and it would be helpful if we could know who that is so that we could provide that information in some fashion, one way or the other.
That's great.
If the board doesn't disagree with that.
No.
That's just a phone call. I couldn't.
A fine idea.
So.
I see Drew uncapping his pen even.
Something really quick.
Yes.
I just want to, it's worth mentioning in the recognitions, the newsletter of the town, that kudos to the manager and his managing staff for the town of Carborough. Most recent comprehensive annual financial report has received the prestigious Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting by the Government Finance Officers Association. So our taxpayers have worked. Thank you very much. All right.
Move we adjourn.
Second.
All those in favor signify saying aye.
Regular Tuesday night.
Aye.
Election returns.
Yeah.